Stand, please. Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-5414. Melvin A. Jones, our host, Mr. Michael J. Ashton, Commissioner of Social Security. Ms. Osborne, for the Minister of Ed, the Haynes, the Appellate.
Good morning, Judge Garland. My name is Stephen Goldblatt, and I'm a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. I was appointed in this matter as an amicus curiae in support of Mr. Jones. With the court's permission, argument today will be presented by Jonathan K. Osborne, a third-year law student at Georgetown, who will be appearing in conformity with the rules of this court.
Thank you. You have our permission.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Osborne.
With the court's permission, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court. Under settled law, Dr. Sardana's conclusion that Mr. Jones could only sit for 4 hours during an 8-hour workday is entitled to presumptive weight unless the ALJ pointed to substantial evidence in the record to the contrary and explained his reasoning. Because no such evidence or explanation exists, this court should reverse the ruling of the lower court and remand for the calculation of the back disability benefits due Mr. Jones. The government agrees at page 21 of its brief that Dr. Sardana's conclusion that Mr. Jones could only sit for 4 hours is dispositive of disability, and there is no substantial evidence in this record to the contrary. The government relies on reports from consulting doctors Srinivas, Kumar, and Lopez. I will address these reports in turn. First, reports from Drs. Kumar and Srinivas were submitted in 2004, 2005, and 2007. But none of these reports evaluated Mr. Jones' back and its effect on his ability to sit during the workday.
Didn't Dr. Kuma actually have something in his report that said that actually contradicted Sardana's report?
Your Honor, the report from Dr. Kuma found that Mr. Jones could only sleep for 6 hours. But that report was not contradictory because he did not evaluate Mr. Jones' back pain. Dr. Kumar evaluated Mr. Jones in 2004 for the first time, in fact, 2 years before Mr. Jones even alleged disability as a result of his back. Dr. Kumar's report limits its review to Mr. Jones' heart problems and his lung problems. Dr. Srinivas only evaluated Mr. Jones' heart and his obesity.
What about Dr. Kumar checked off the box about 6 hours in an 8-hour workday with respect to sitting, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's really the key issue, isn't it?
Certainly, Your Honor.
So did he then evaluate the thing that is the key issue in contradiction to the treating physician?
Yes, Your Honor, but that report is not substantially contradictory because Dr. Kumar did not evaluate Mr. Jones' back pain. He limited his review. Here on this record, Dr. Sardana, the treating physician, is the only physician who evaluated Mr. Jones' ability to sit after considering all of his impairments. And Dr. Sardana, in his report, indicated that Mr. Jones' spinal stenosis, his heart problems, his lung problems, and his gout contributed to his inability to sit for longer than 4 hours.
Dr. Sardana, what's his, is he an internist, or is he, does he have a specialty?
Your Honor, my understanding is that he's an internist. And in this case, he evaluated Mr. Jones from 2004 up until 2008, and his treatment notes indicate that Mr. Jones suffered from all of the impairments that Dr. Sardana later indicated on the 2008
Does
medical.
Does an internist have any expertise in how long an individual can sit?
Your Honor.
In the treating physician rule, does it matter whether the treating, for example, if a person has some sort of skin disease, one would think that they'd go to a dermatologist, but if their regular physician is simply a general practitioner, does that treating physician rule apply in that situation?
Yes, Your Honor, and in this context.
It does. It doesn't matter what the specialty of the physician is.
Your Honor, the requirement is certainly that the treating physician's opinion be based on sound medical evidence. And here the requirement is that Dr. Sardana would have reviewed the MRI reports, chest x-rays, and EKGs in evaluating Mr. Jones' impairments. And these are the same types of reports that this court held confirmed the treating physician's opinion in Butler that the individual could not stoop. Here, Dr. Sardana treated Mr. Jones for a number of years, and moreover, if the ALJ questioned the medicine on which the treating physician based his opinion, then he had a responsibility under SSA regulations to recontact Dr. Sardana or to develop evidence in the record to contradict Dr. Sardana's finding. Here, he failed to do so. And in fact, the government's reliance on reports from Dr. Lopez, whose report is certainly in tension with Dr. Sardana's, is also misguided for several reasons.
Let me ask you about Dr. Lopez. Do we have to address the treating physician rule if you're right about the new evidence here?
Yes, Your Honor, because under question one, the treating physician rule, Dr. Sardana's finding compels a finding that Mr. Jones is incapable of doing sedentary work. And here, as a matter of law, Mr. Jones is disabled. And the question of whether or not Dr. Lopez's credibility is undermined would come into play if this court finds against Mr. Jones with respect to the treating physician rule. And here, Dr. Lopez's report was significant in the ALJ's decision in a number of ways, not only in his undermining of Dr. Sardana, but first with respect to the disagreements between those two reports. Dr. Sardana opined that Mr. Jones had difficulties with sitting, standing, and other limitations that regarded his lower extremities. And Dr. Lopez, in 2007, formed the opinion that Mr. Jones had no limitations whatsoever in his range of motion as a result of his spine and his ability to do work-related activities as a result of his upper or lower extremities. That is in tension with Dr. Sardana's earlier findings. However,
is there any difference between, well, is there a difference between the regulation and the rule that somehow crept into our jurisprudence?
No, Judge Randolph. Both rules require an ALJ who departs from the opinion of a treating physician to explain his reasoning and to point to substantial evidence that contradicts the treating physician on the limitation in question.
So the argument is that the ALJ violated the regulation.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But that, where does that lead? That doesn't lead to a declaration that that Mr. Jones is disabled, does it?
Your Honor, it could, depending on the type of violation. Here, Mr. Jones's argument.
Don't we just vacate and remand because the ALJ didn't articulate his rationale? That doesn't necessarily lead to a decision that the individual is disabled, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And he is now on disability, right?
Yes, Your Honor. As of
so
March.
So we're talking about what a 2-3 year period of payments.
Yes, Your Honor. It would be the period between 2004 and March 3rd, 2008. And to address the bench's earlier concern, the finding of disability would be up to the administration. But here, the ALJ's finding that Mr. Jones could only sit for 6 hours during the workday is not supported by substantial evidence in the record. And for that reason, a remand for the ALJ to calculate back benefits would be appropriate because Dr. Sardana's finding compels the later finding, and the government agrees that Mr. Jones cannot perform sedentary work. With respect to the explanation requirement, the clear rule from Butler and Sims is that on remand, an ALJ, like the ALJ in this case, would have to further explain the reasons for the weight that he attached to Dr. Sardana's opinion.
But your position is there's no explanation he can come up with because it's not supported by substantial evidence. So,
precisely, Your Honor.
It gets back to my question, what's the point of remanding then, if you're right?
Your Honor, the more appropriate remedy, given that there's a lack of substantial evidence, would be merely a remand for the ALJ to calculate the benefits and the start date for the benefits due Mr. Jones. And, Your Honors, I see that I've entered my rebuttal time.
I just want to ask one fact question again on Dr. Kumar's report. There's a reference, I think, in your brief that the report was prepared before the accident. The report that I have at JA-342 has a March 1st, 07 date, which would have been after the accident, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and to clarify, Dr. Kumar completed two reports. The report that the government references in its brief is to the 2004 report, which preceded the accident. However, it really makes no difference because Dr. Kumar never evaluated the impact of Mr. Jones on his ability to sit.
Just back up. On JA 343 is where he checks off and says cannot sit for a total of about 6 hours in an eight, that he can sit for a total of about 6 hours in an 8-hour workday. Is that report the result of an examination that happened after the accident, or just a looking back at the records from before the accident?
Your Honor, at that point in the disability process, my understanding is that Dr. Kumar would have evaluated Mr. Jones' medical records.
But not physically. So he wouldn't have seen him after the accident?
Your Honor, that's not clear from the record.
So what do you mean when you say that he didn't evaluate his ability to sit?
Your Honor, at page 342 of the joint appendix,
yes,
the doctor listed the impairments that he reviewed. And it states that he reviewed Mr. Jones' cardiomyopathy and hypertension, emphysema, and obesity.
I'm sorry, where is that? That's his JA 342?
Yes, sir.
Which box are we talking about?
At the very top.
Primary diagnosis? Oh, current event, which?
It will be primary diagnosis,
yes.
Secondary diagnosis,
yes.
And other alleged impairments.
Right, but those are just the diagnosis. That doesn't mean that he didn't evaluate his ability to sit, does it?
Your Honor, he certainly evaluated his ability to sit, but the record indicates that the only doctor who evaluated all of Mr. Jones' impairments, including his back pain, and then made a quantified finding with respect to Mr. Jones' ability to sit was Dr. Sardana.
All right, thank you.
May I ask you, on remand, could the ALJ consider new evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. Under 42 U.S.C. Section 405G, the ALJ could consider the letter that Mr. Jones received from the D.C. Board of Medicine indicating that Dr. Lopez violated a provision of the Health Occupations Revisions Act in his consultation with Mr. Jones.
Well, my question is, could he take new evidence? In other words, beyond that, because one question is whether there's any evidence to contradict Dr. Sardano's report. Could he, on remand, actually look at any other report, or would it just be limited to the controversy about Dr. Lopez's report?
Your Honor, under Section 405G, the remand will be limited to the evidence that this court directs the ALJ to consider. There are no further questions.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you all.
May it please the court. I disagree with the statement that Mr. Osborne just made, that the remand would be limited to the evidence that's already in the record. On a remand, the ALJ can consider other evidence as long as it's prior to the decision. In other words, evidence of the condition at the time that the decision was made.
Not limited to the reason that we remand, if we were to remand for new evidence, he's not limited to that.
That's correct. It's not limited to they can accept new evidence, but it would have to relate to the time period before. Because actually, as I think the court noted, and as Mr. Osborne said, his client is now on disability. And I think if they're on disability from March 3, 2008, it means that the new application, I think, must have been April of 2008. So the evidence on the remand would have to relate to his condition prior to the judge's decision, because some of his illnesses are progressive, the congestive heart failure and the back situation. We feel that the ALJ did not violate the treating physician's rule. The appellant's counsel has indicated that they think we should look at this evaluation under procedural and substantive aspects, those two aspects. Procedurally, even though the ALJ did not specifically say in his opinion that Dr. Sardana was the treating physician. I think you can look to the record, particularly the transcript of the hearing, and you will see that he considered that a very important, views were very important, because in the administrative record, the transcript of the hearing, there was a break. They had the vocational expert on the stand, and the judge was asking the hypothetical questions. If you assume this, is he disabled? That. There's a break, and they ask the ALJ to look at Exhibit 20F. That's in the transcript, current pages. It starts at JA440. That exhibit includes Dr. Sardano's final, his report that he could only sit, that the claimant could only sit for 4 hours. So, and then the ALJ said after the break, he said he's disabled. So if it's 4 hours, he's disabled. If it's 6 hours, he's not disabled.
But the requirement we have is a little bit stronger than that. It's to explain why you reject the treating physician's position, right?
That's correct.
And at page JA37, the ALJ notes Dr. Sardana's position that the patient can only sit for 4 hours. But he doesn't give a reason why he rejects that, other than to say he rejects it.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the test here would be the test that is applied to all administrative proceedings, and that is the court should uphold the decision. It may not be of ideal clarity if the agency's path may reasonably be discerned. And
well, that's not the rule that we gave in Butler. The rule we gave in Butler is that there has to be an explanation. Explain his reasons for rejecting the treating physician's conclusion.
Well, there is a tension, Your Honor, I think, between Williams, which is still the good law in this circuit, and Butler, in that in Williams, the court pointed out that we think that the ALJ did not err in failing to defer to Dobbs' diagnosis under the treating physician rule. Now, Dobbs, I guess, was the treating physician. The ALJ did not expressly state his reason for not applying the treating physician rule. That he did not do that is of no moment, because he noted the contradictory evidence in the record.
Well, what contradictory evidence in the record was noted in this case? Where on page 37 does he note evidence which contradicts Dr. Sardana's conclusion the patient can only sit for 4 hours?
Well, for example, if you look down to the next to the last paragraph, he references the state agency personnel. And actually, he points out, and that included...
Just be clear about what I mean by this. In Williams, it was express. There was one thing that the treating physician said and something completely contradictory. Now, where, and that was noted by the ALJ. Where do you see that here?
It's not in there explicitly. You have to derive it, Your Honor, from looking at the fairly lengthy discussion by the ALJ of the plaintiff's condition. But he does not expressly...
You agree there's no place where he says either that I reject Dr. Sardana's view that he can only sit for 4 hours for the following reason, or where he says, and here's somebody else, another doctor, who says he can sit for more than 4 hours. There's nothing like either.
There is nothing.
Can I just ask you about Kumar for just 1 second? Is that would be your best argument, except for the fact that it's not mentioned by the ALJ. But was Dr. Kumar's based on an examination that took place after the accident, or we just can't tell that from the record?
It's a state agency report, Your Honor, and they are not based on a physical examination. They are based on the records.
And by which that you mean they look at the other doctor's records? Is that
the medical records? Yes, Your Honor, that have been accumulated. They would, you know, they look at them and then they come to that conclusion. Now, the interesting thing about Dr. Sardana's statement that he could only sit for 4 hours is, unlike Butler, in Butler, the treating physician, there were copious notes continuously saying the person cannot stoop, and the ALJ rejected that. In this case, there is exactly one reference in the record that the claimant could not sit for more than 4 hours, exactly one, and that's Dr. Sardana's. So it is not similar to Butler. It's completely different.
Can I ask you, you say that the ALJ followed the treating physician rule. When you say that, are you relying on the evidence from Dr. Lopez that he cites?
Yes, we're relying on that.
Okay, so does that mean that we need to remand on the basis of new evidence?
No, Your Honor, for several reasons. First of all, the evidence is not new. The issue of Dr. Lopez's examination is discussed in the transcript of the hearing. It was raised by his attorneys below, who are different from his current attorneys. It's not new evidence.
But it's new in the sense that before you only had the patient's allegation, and now he has a statement by the board of medicine that there was a violation of the act.
Your Honor, we vehemently disagree with that.
With what I just said?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what, I'll just read the letter, which is, unless you're not suggesting this is a false letter or something like that. Right?
Your Honor, I'm suggesting that letter does not mean what it says.
Ah.
That is my suggestion.
Okay, but you agree that the letter does say, quote, the board has determined a violation did occur, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Ah.
I mean, the letter is fairly damning, but when we looked into it, we discovered that in point of fact, that letter is very inartfully worded. Now, that, we talked to the lawyer who worked with the D.C. Board of Medicine, and we attached as Exhibit A to our brief his email, which says very straightforward, there has been no finding of misconduct.
Well, that's not what it says. So that it's a little inartfully worded, too, if that's what you thought it said. It just says that there's been no finding sufficient for sanctions, right?
That, well, it says
we're talking about what you marked as Exhibit A, right?
Yes.
Okay, so this says, at this point, no sanctions have been imposed. It doesn't say that he hasn't been found in violation, does it?
Your Honor, that interpretation, it seems to me, would raise some very serious questions.
I'm trying to not interpret at all. I'm trying to just read, and all it says here is, as opposing counsel points out, that all it says here is no sanctions have been imposed. It doesn't say. I mean, there are different possibilities. One possibility is first you find a violation, and then you decide what the right sanction is. And you'll say, I certainly don't know what actually is going on here, but the email doesn't directly contradict the letter, unless you can show me where you think it does.
Well, you're right. It says here, at this point, no sanctions have been imposed, and then it goes on to say, nor has any of the deliberative process that precedes the imposition of such even be initiated.
Right.
Now, he hasn't had his day in court, so saying we should assume
I'm not saying anything. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what you said that the first letter is inartfully worded, but the first letter seems quite damning and express. This one says at this point no sanctions have been imposed and the deliberative process that precedes it hasn't been initiated. That can mean, I suppose, a deliberative process relating to sanctions rather than the deliberative process relating to discipline. And it would seem odd for them to send a letter saying that the board has determined a violation if it hadn't. And maybe the answer to this is the one that Judge Brown suggested and that you answered, which is that if we send this back, the ALJ is not stuck with a letter and an email, but rather can actually find out which of the two are inartfully worded. That would be true, right? If we were to send it back for determination of this question based on this evidence, the ALJ would be able to look into the question of what exactly the board has found.
I don't think that is correct, Your Honor. But let me go to a preliminary point, and that is, in order to have sanctions, there has to be a violation. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's no violation, you don't get sanctions. Mm-hmm. Therefore, there has been no finding of a violation. This whole issue about Dr. Lopez, essentially it's going to lead to a dead end. Dr. Lopez has absolutely no memory of his examination of the appellant. Apparently, appellant's orthopedic doctor who operated on him as a child.
That's Dr. Moskowitz?
That's Dr. Moskowitz, Your Honor. He submitted a statement which was attached to the district court brief that was filed by Mr. Jones, and that statement says that essentially that the report by Dr. Lopez is false and unreliable. Now, that's not going to be evidence, I don't think, that would be admissible. That's one doctor's opinion that he disagrees with Dr. Lopez.
Well, I'm not sure. Isn't the whole issue here we have a bunch of doctors who have different views?
That's correct. It's that way in all the cases.
Yes, so why would it be inadmissible that Dr. Moskowitz, who, by the way, is an orthopedic surgeon, unlike Dr. Lopez?
Your Honor, Dr. Lopez is an orthopedic.
Oh, he is also?
He works at GW. Uh-huh. He's one of their, what do they call it, GW Medical Associates. Uh-huh. So he practices at GW. Uh-huh. He is an experienced orthopedic surgeon.
But so is Dr. Moskowitz.
Dr. Moskowitz is an experienced right. orthopedic surgeon. Dr. Moskowitz, in 2009, made this statement that, in his opinion, Mr. Jones is disabled. Now, first of all, that statement is not admissible because the issue of disability is reserved for the commission. It's not reserved. I mean, you don't bring in a doctor who says, I find him disabled from work, period. That is not admissible.
What about the transcript of the Superior Court proceeding in which the judge says the court finds that there was a false representation of material fact in Dr. Lopez's report?
That, Your Honor, that would not be binding on Dr. Lopez, would not be binding on the Social Security.
It wouldn't be binding, but would it not be relevant to this issue, which is how much weight Social Security should have given to Dr. Lopez?
I don't think it would be relevant, Your Honor, because the argument that Mr. Jones and his lawyer were making was that there had been some sort of fraudulent misrepresentation. All that we have is the fact the judge said, well, I'll find there was a false misrepresentation, but there's no evidence that it was deliberately made. Now, that statement is of no import, because in order to have collateral estoppel, the point decided has got to have been necessary for the judge's decision.
I'm not sure why this is a question of collateral estoppel. Mr. Jones's complaint states that although Dr. Lopez claimed he did a thorough examination, in fact, he did only a 5-minute observation and didn't do any of the things that he put in his report. The judge says the court finds there was a false representation of material fact. Plaintiff satisfies this by clear and convincing evidence. Now, if you were the ALJ, even without collateral estoppel, wouldn't that give you some pause as to whether to trust Dr. Lopez's report?
I don't think so, Your Honor. But let me say also that you mentioned 5 minutes. In the transcript, I believe that Mr. Jones stated that it was about 20 minutes, that was his time. And so he is not happy with what Dr. Lopez found. But I really don't think the statement by the judge in the Superior Court case would be relevant to the ALJ, because the ALJ has to make the decision on the record that was made. And that record, on the other side, all that we have is a conclusory statement by Dr. Moskovitz, which apparently was relied on by the Superior Court.
How much weight did the ALJ give to Dr. Sardana's finding that this gentleman could only sit for 4 hours in an eight-hour workday?
He rejected it, Your Honor. I mean, he did not do... Yeah, he did. He rejected it because if you look at the transcript...
Well, he came up with 6 hours, but, I mean, how much weight did he give to that finding?
I don't know, Your Honor. I mean, he
I don't know either.
I mean, don't know, Your Honor.
He doesn't say anything.
Yeah.
The regulation requires the ALJ to state how much weight he is giving to the treating physician's opinion, doesn't it? I mean, the very last sentence of it, I don't have it in front of me, but...
I don't have that...
I think it does. I think it says that. So he violated the regulation. Forget about the judicial rule. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't say, the regulation doesn't say anything if we can discern the reasons. It just says you have to give a statement of the weight you're giving to the treating physician's opinion.
Actually,
so unless you're arguing, I think you may have a point about Williams. Williams seems to me to state the harmless error rule applies in administrative cases as well as in civil and criminal cases. And Williams seems to me to rest on a harmless error. It doesn't matter because we, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't know. I don't see that argument, number one, being available to you here. And number two, I don't think you make it.
Your Honor, I think if you look at Joint Appendix 37, which is the ALJ's decision.
I've looked at it, yeah.
He directly says, he talks about Dr. Sardana. He says the report provides a basis for finding of some limitations, et cetera, but not below the sedentary level. Dr. Sardano's report and the balance of the medical record do not rule out work within the scope of residual functional capacity adopted here. So isn't that giving weight? Isn't that giving weight?
What Dr. Sardana's report is on a form issued by the Social Security Administration, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
There's no space and no requirement and no instruction on that form for the doctor to explain anything other than his diagnosis.
I think that's incorrect, Your Honor. And if we look in the transcript at I need to find the...
Page 337, I think.
337, okay. No, that's a report.
Yeah, there is a place, I think.
No, that's wrong.
Your Honor.
It's 300 and something.
335.
335.
That's.
No, that's.
No.
That's a report from Dr. Sardana.
Where's the transcript that you're talking, the part that you're talking about? That's in the 400s, right?
Yeah,
the transcript?
That's in the 440, yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's look at 440. But I would note that that.
378.
What, Your Honor?
378.
It seems to me as part of, these are progress notes, but I think if you look up at 334 and 35.
This is not progress notes. This is the medical assessment ability to do work-related activities.
Your Honor, I suspect it just occurred to me, maybe you are using the numbers at the top of the page, and I'm using the numbers at the bottom of the page.
I'm using the numbers at the bottom of the page.
Okay. Go to page 337?
378.
Oh, 378. Let me look at that. Hmm. Your Honor, if I, it looks like to me there is a space where he can make comments.
Well, it says, what are the medical findings, diagnosis? And he, so he said, here they are. Spinal stenosis, back pain, congestive heart failure, emphysema, and a gout. That's the diagnosis.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. If you look back at the earlier one that I was looking at, actually, is it's a report by Dr. Sardana to the disability benefits people in 2005, and that's JA334335. There is a place for remarks there. Interestingly enough, in that report, Dr. Sardano did not list back pain or back problems.
That was before the accident, right?
Yes, but there's no indication in the record that the accident affected the back, or the severity of it. The accident, the only thing in the record is that...
But it compressed his spinal cord.
Well, I think he complained, Your Honor, of neck and shoulder problems. But it would take me a minute to dig through the record to find that.
All right.
There's no evidence that it was a massive accident that essentially disabled it.
Well, this report, Mr. Haynes, is 3 years later, right?
The one I cited as having a space was 2005.
And then the one that at 378 is at, 3 years later.
That's correct, Your Honor. I don't know if it's 3 years, but it's certainly, well, certainly it's substantially later.
It's 2008.
Okay. But we think, you know, the test here is it cannot be that the ALJ has to be perfect. Otherwise, you know, we're going to have serious problems. If you look at his opinion, he definitely considered Dr. Sardano's report, and he explicitly stated that to the extent he didn't adopt it, he found that there was conflicting evidence. And if you read the opinion, you see the conflicting evidence.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hayes.
Thank you, Your Honor. For your honors. Thank you.
Does Mr. Osborne have any time left? All right, we'll give you another minute.
Mm-hmm. Your Honors, I have two quick points on rebuttal. The first has to do with Dr. Kumar. The ALJ's opinion at page 37 does reference Dr. Kumar. In fact, he expressly disagrees with Dr. Kumar's report, referenced as Exhibit 15F, in the paragraph following his discussion of Dr. Sardana's report, where he states, the undersigned has carefully considered whether claimant's capacity allows him to sustain light work as the state agency found. The undersigned disagrees, and he goes on to discuss his disagreement with the reports from Dr. Kumar. Moreover, Dr. Kumar is a one-time consulting physician, and in Sims, this court explained that even reports from two consulting physicians were not enough without an adequate explanation to override the presumption in the treating physician's favor. The second point has to do with remedy. On remand, the ALJ would have to consider the record as it stood in March 2008, and because Dr. Sardana's conclusion compels a finding of disability, that will be the appropriate remedy in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Osborne and Mr. Goldblatt, you were assigned, appointed by the court to represent the appellant in this matter, and the court thanks you very much for your assistance. Of course, we always thank the United States for its role in the case. Thank you.